Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out this evening and supporting our author events. And thank you so much for supporting independent bookstores. We appreciate you greatly. It's truly a pleasure to introduce Monica Ali, who has been dubbed one of the best young British writers and a unique voice of a generation. She will talk about her new novel, In the Kitchen. As you know, her novel, Brick Lane, was a bestseller, nominated for the Man Booker Prize, the LA Times Book Award, and is now a film. In the Kitchen is about a man in crisis, a chef named Gabriel Lightfoot. Between trying to run a tight kitchen and make a name for himself as a chef, there's murder, tragedy, relationship issues, and more to make this contemporary novel something you'll remember for a very long time. Monica Ali was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and grew up in England. She lives in London with her family. Please welcome Monica Ali.
Thank you. Thanks, Lisa. And thank you very much to all of you for coming. I do think that forsaking the comfort of your own homes and coming out to hear an author reading and staying awake during that reading is truly heroic. I always fall asleep in readings. I mean, not my own reading. That would be tragic, wouldn't it? But it's quite comforting being read to, I find. I think it's a hangover from childhood. So full marks to anyone who stays awake for the next 15 or so minutes. And those of you who don't, well, I know how you feel. Be fine. I spent a year researching In the Kitchen, and several years before that, reading around it and thinking about it. So it has been something of a journey to get here. And the book, too, is about a journey. It's about an emotional journey that the protagonist goes on. As Lisa mentioned, he's called Gabriel. He's the executive head chef, rather grandly titled, of the Imperial Hotel in London. And at the start of the book, he is ambitious and successful and in control. And then a number of things happen which pile the pressure onto him. So the dead body of a kitchen porter is discovered in the basement of the kitchen. His father is diagnosed with cancer, and against his better judgment, he starts cheating on his girlfriend. So he makes some bad decisions in life, and his standards of professional behaviour start to slip as well. As in this first scene that I'm going to read, I'm going to read two short scenes. It's a way into the book, so he's starting to slightly unravel at this point, and he begins, when we open the scene, in the kitchen, watching his multinational staff at work. During dinner service, he prowled the kitchen. He watched the dishwasher stacking plates and scouring pans. This one was from Somalia. The other was from Sudan, or maybe the other way around. The man wiped his hands on his overalls and hosed down the sink. He dragged a massive stock pot over, ran the water, and started scrubbing, nearly up to his armpits, his head sunk low as if doing his best to hide. If you were a dishwasher, it wasn't good to be noticed. The only time you were noticed was if you'd done something wrong, dropped a tray of glasses, or left some grime in a pot. Gabriel drifted away to the heart of the kitchen. "Geez," said Victor, wheeling. "Didn't hear you come up. You're like a ghost or something, man." Gabe watched his boys, Benny and Suleiman, busy at their stations. Nikolai, too old for this work, pressed a hand to the small of his back. Ivan stoked his fires. A waitress came to say that a customer had a complaint and wanted to see the chef. "About the food?" said Gabriel. The waitress didn't know. She led him to the table and turned on her heel. "Hello," said Gabriel. "How can I help you?" "I've got a complaint," said the man. "I'm sorry to say." He looked all right. Shirt and chinos uniform. Probably a corporate lawyer on a dress-down Friday, but not too full of himself. "Sorry to hear it," said Gabe. "Hope I can put things right." "Take a look at my plate," said the customer. "You don't like the steak? Is it overcooked?" "Steak's fine, but the plate, look at it." The man's girlfriend pressed her fingers to her lips. Gabriel leaned down and examined the plate. "You'd like a different one?" "See that?" said the man, pointing with his fork at a trace of something on the rim. "That's not been washed properly. That's a bit of old cack on there." The girlfriend smiled beneath her fingers. It seemed to egg him on. "When you're paying well over 10 quid for a main course, you might expect a garnish, but you don't expect it to be made of old cack." The girlfriend sniggered. The man leaned back, swelling his chest, splaying his legs as if his balls had suddenly grown. "I'll change your plate for you, sir," said Gabriel. "I'll get you a fresh steak as well." "I mean," said the man, enjoying himself too much to stop, "you're serving this lovely meal and it's decorated with sickup. Could you have a word with whoever's responsible?" "Okay, David," said the girlfriend, her back stiffening, her eyes on Gabriel. But the man was dining out now on the sound of his own voice. "Is it too much to ask for a clean plate? For a bit of spit and polish? Is it? I mean, come on." "Certainly," said Gabriel. "I'll do it myself, right away." With a flourish, he removed the man's plate and raised it close to his mouth. He spat on the rim. "There, sir. That's the spit. Now for the polish." He gave it a vigorous wipe with his sleeve. He returned the plate to the table and bowed. "Enjoy your meal. Bon appetit." So you may have got from that while Gabriel is annoyed with the diner for trying to get the dishwasher, the porter, into trouble, he's only really dimly aware of who his dishwashers are. And when I was researching in hotels, I interviewed everyone from the managers, the general managers of the hotels, through to the receptionists, but it was always the kitchen that I was the most drawn to. And that's partly because kitchens, commercial kitchens, they're great crucibles for dramatic confrontation in their high pressure environment. So, you know, there's a lot going on in them. And it was also because they are like United Nations assemblies down there. I mean, you get all different nationalities. So really rich source of diverse stories from all around the world. Obviously attractive to a writer, but although other people's stories, I think, can be very enriching, they can also be exhausting and overwhelming. And Gabriel, at least at first in the book, he doesn't really want to know. He doesn't really want to know the backgrounds of his staff. So he's running a business. And if you might have to fire somebody in the future, you don't necessarily want to know if they've been through something traumatic already to get to where they are today. And Gabriel, as we all are, is busy grappling with his own story, with his own life history. And part of that story belongs to the north of England, to a Lancashire mill town, or an ex mill town because most of the mills have closed down a little while ago. But he grew up there, and so did I, in one of those ex-mill towns. This book is about family secrets and relationships, and also just family life as much as it is about anything else. So in the next scene that I'm going to read, Gabriel has gone back up north to visit his father, who's called Ted, and his grandmother, whom he calls Nana. And Nana's getting on, and her memory, as you will see, is beginning to go. It's thirsty work being a novelist, you know. Nana, on her third sherry, grew sufficiently animated to sit up straight in her chair. The loose, soft skin of her face trembled with words that sought to escape, while her mouth prepared itself slowly for action, warming up with a few mouldings and partings of the lips. Gabe studied her closely, trying to remember how she used to look when he was a boy. The years, it seemed, had robbed her of the singular, all her features melting into a generality of old age. No matter how hard he looked, he couldn't really see her, just the lines and folds and wrinkles, a second call at the other end of life. "Listen to this, Gabriel," she said finally. "It's Edith who told me, and you can't say truer than that. Happened to a neighbour of hers. Well, she lives down the beaches, doesn't she? Been there since... Ooh, you're going back a long time now." Nana hesitated, floundering for a moment. She plunged on. "Anyway, this chap sat there of an evening, in bed, minding his own, when he hears a noise from up there." Nana pointed to the ceiling, with a finger turned querulous by arthritis and an incipient sense of outrage. "That's queer," he thinks. "Sounds like there's a rat got into the attic, a big one." "Nana," said Gabriel, beginning to suspect where this might be going. "Prince Street it was," said Nana, dabbing her left eye, which appeared to suffer some continual low-grade seepage. "Down the beaches. You remember, Gabe?" "The beaches. Course I do, Nana. Where I learned to ride my bike, remember? Only the other side of the main road from Astley Street. But we're talking about 30-odd years ago now, aren't we, Nana? We're not talking about today." The beaches was a stretch of concrete with a mouldering fountain and a bench that lay between the terraces of the old town, where a German bomb had cracked the rows apart. Gabe, in the days when the Earth's circumference could be described in the swing of a conker, had spent many an hour there, perfecting the art of mooching about. Nana leaned so far forward that Gabe feared she would topple out of the chair. "That's queer, he thinks, this chap." Nana's features might have blurred with time, but her voice was distinct enough. It moved up a register, and she began to enunciate more carefully, the better to articulate her disgust. "So he goes to fetch a stepladder, and he climbs up to the loft. He gets the trap door open, and he's got a torch with him, of course." Gabriel knew what she was going to say and fervently wished that she wouldn't. He looked at Ted, sitting with his hands on the sides of the chair, the snub of the left little finger, its final joint missing, pressing into the fabric. "Well, you'll never guess what he saw," said Nana. She clamped her lips together. "Oh," said Gabe, "I think I will." "The whole attic," said Nana, in an ecstasy of indignation, "was full of Pakistans." "No, Nana, not this." "Yes, oh yes, got the mattresses and whatnot, and there they all are in a line, sleeping between their shifts, and there's others what come to take their places when this lot go off to the mill. The chap got right to the bottom of it, you see. And you know the way all the attics in them terraces are joined? Well, there's Pakistans all down the row, right to the end of the street. Bartlett Street it was. June told me all about it because this chap's a neighbour, and she said to me, "Phyllis, what is the world coming to?" And I said, "June, I just don't know anymore. I really don't." Nana sat back and dabbed at her eye. "Nana," said Gabriel, "have you heard the phrase urban myth?" He must have been 9 or 10 years old when he first heard that story. "Best leave it, Gabe," said Ted. "Clock's broken, if you know what I mean. Bit confused now and then." "Who's confused?" snapped Nana. "And I'm not deaf neither." Ted smiled. "Still the full shilling, that's right. What was it Albert used to say? If our Phyllis was any sharper, she'd cut herself. Isn't that the truth?" Nana's mouth puckered and twitched. "Eee," she said, in a long whistling sigh. "It's been a good life, that much I can say. When I married Bert, 17 years old, that's all, and he was 21, and we'd never a cross word." Nana's voice and face were aflutter with emotion. "Not in all those years." "Never a cross word," said Ted. "That's right, Phyllis, that's right. And I'll leave it there. Thank you."
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.